All right, it's time for us to get started in here. Thank you very much for being here for this continuation of this class. As David mentioned, this is our second to last class, so we are going very rapidly through this book. We've been going through kind of six chapters at a time. This gives us kind of an outline of where we are right now in the book of Numbers. We're going to be trying to travel through chapters 25 through 30 tonight is our goal. I believe in us. I think we can do it. So we'll try and get through that. So we're looking at here, we just finished talking about Balak, and if you remember, or Balaam and Balak asking him to curse the people of Israel, and you know how that did not work out so well for him, and the famous incident with the talking donkey, and even more famous, somebody who fussed back at the donkey, right? So we talked about those events. And we're going to talk about Balaam, that began the end of Balaam's life. And we'll talk about that a little bit later on. That comes around in Joshua chapter 13, some of the events kind of that unfold here tonight. So we'll be looking at those things. So you want to turn to chapter 25 of the book of Numbers. We have some exciting things in these sections of these chapters we'll be looking at tonight. And we also go back to the numbering. I don't know if you remember why the book of Numbers is called Numbers. Do you guys remember? Any guesses? We have a census. Not only one, we get two censuses. We could do it twice. So we'll be looking at the second one tonight as well. But before we get there, we have this incident. So they are just got done with Balaam trying to curse them. He ended up blessing them, and that kind of came to nothing. And then we have this incident where they, while Israel remained at Shittim, the people began to play the harlot with the daughters of Moab. Now, when you read throughout the book, or the Bible, and you read through the prophetic books, whenever people of God go away from God and serve other gods, he uses the concept that they play the harlot, right? They've gone after other gods and served them, because in his mind, and it should be in the mind of the people, and that they're in a covenant relationship with him. And so when they break that covenant relationship, it is though you've broken the marriage vow that you would have one God, right? And so he says they've played the harlot, and they do this not only spiritually but physically in this context. People began to play the harlot with the daughters of Moab. Now, if you remember, Moab is just across the river from the Promised Land. They're in that region right now, and they're there. But verse 2 says, they invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. So Israel joined themselves to the Baals of Peor, and the Lord was angry against Israel. And the Lord said to Moses, take all the leaders of them and gather them before them. So he is angry about this. Now, what was it that the people, what did they do wrong here in these verses 2 and 3. What did they do wrong? What's that? Yes. Yep. They invited them to the sacrifices. Does it say that they actually sacrificed? What does it say? They ate the stuff that was sacrificed down there, and they kind of bowed down whenever they were, you know, bowing down with everybody else, and it says that they joined themselves. So they participated in those events, in those worship services. They participated in those things and became partakers of these bad things. Now, is it possible that we can be, I don't really believe in this, but we go and do things like that we know God does not like? I don't really believe in this. I'm doing something that, you know, I'm going to be a good influence on here. I'm going to go and do these things, and I'm going to be the one influencing somebody here. Has that happened before? You know, people make the arguments, well, I'm not drinking when I go to the bars with everybody else. I'm being here to be a good influence. It doesn't always work that way. Even if they were trying to be a good influence and learn about their culture and that kind of stuff, this was too far. This was a line too far, right? God says, you're not going into this to be an anthropologist and learn about all these different things and that kind of stuff. No, they need to leave, right? You're going to wipe them out. But they crossed the line here. And they joined in on what they were not supposed to be joining in on. And so the Lord says to Moses, take the leaders and the people and execute them in broad daylight before the Lord, so that the fierce anger of the Lord may turn away from Israel. And so Moses said to the judges, each of you slay his men who have joined themselves to Baal Peor. And so they do this thing. But while they're doing that, and there many people died, okay, there's this kind of side event that takes place, beginning in verse 6. Then behold, one of the sons of Israel came and brought to his relatives a Midianite woman. He just came bebopping into camp with this Midianite woman that everybody knows, right, that they did wrong with the Midianites, and he comes into camp with this Midianite woman. In the sight of Moses and the sight of all the congregation, zero shame about what he's doing. And while they were weeping at the doorway of the tent of the meeting, so they're weeping over those who have just died because of this. And this guy brings one of these women into camp. Not a good idea. When Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, saw it, he arose from the midst of the congregation, took a spear in his hand, and he went after the man of Israel into the tent and pierced them both through, the man of Israel and the woman through the body. So the plague of the sons of Israel was checked. And those who died by the plague were 24,000. What they were doing in the tent, I don't know. Then the King James, it said he pierced them through like belly and back and like just stuck them to the ground like an hors d'oeuvre, right? But he finished this. But still 24,000 people died because sin came into the camp. God was very serious. And when we read this, we think, well, that's kind of harsh. Why is God doing this? We forget what God is trying to create here with these people. We forget. We forget that God has selected these people to be a special, holy people unto Him, right? And He's trying to create this holy relationship with them where He is in their presence. He is with them. It is not that God has never been worshipped by anybody before, but what God is trying to set up with them, this covenant relationship, is special and sacred and holy and should be revered, and they were not. That's why it is more intense. That's why there are these things that, like, you know, we wouldn't do that today, right? Because we don't have to. We have a very different relationship with God today because of the sacrifice of His Son. But when we look at these things, God is expecting these things to be obeyed and to be adhered to. And it didn't seem like much, right? But anyway, made a bad decision, and it cost the lives of a lot of people. But what happens here with Phinehas, if we look at this, we see the jealousy of Phinehas here. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, has turned away my wrath from the sons of Israel, in that he was jealous with my jealousy among them, so that I did not destroy the sons of Israel in my jealousy. When we look at what God is concerned about, and we think about God's the emotions of God, I guess to say, and He uses this word jealousy to describe where He was with them, and to say that what Phinehas was doing was after his own heart. He had the jealousy of God. He was jealous for the relationship that God had with His people, jealous and protective of that holiness that He was trying to preserve with His people. In like manner, there are things that we need to be making sure that we keep in tune with God. We know there are things that God is sensitive to, things that He hates, things that He abhors, but also things that He loves, things that He has compassion on, those are people that He has compassion for. If we can get our heart to be in tune, like Phinehas in that moment was decisive, right? He didn't like ask for a committee meeting before he decided to do this, right? He didn't wait until it was a church program before he, you know, took the spear and did this thing. He did it because it needed to be done. And likewise, there are things that we need to do because they need to be done. And because we have our hearts in tune with where God is. And we are attentive to those things. And so He was decisive and went. and did this thing. And we see this, again, this promise of a, because he did this thing. Look in verse 13. He said, "It shall be for him and his descendants after him a covenant of perpetual priesthood, because he was jealous for his God. I made atonement for the sons of Israel." If you want to write out here, Exodus chapter 29, verse 9, where we see that kind of promise was made to Aaron as well. Exodus 29, verse 9. As well. And so that continues here with them. And so it names the name of the person who did this thing, and it names the name of the Midianite woman as well. Cosby was slain, the daughter of Zur. And so it tells them exactly who this person is. look at verse 17. God tells Moses, "Be hostile to the Midianites and strike them, for they have been hostile towards you with their tricks, with which they have deceived you in the affair of Peor and the affair of Cosby and the daughter of the leader of Midian, their sister who was slain on the day of the plague because of Peor." So when we read this passage, was there some intent by the Moabites? what do you think the Moabite intent was? According to this verse, they were tricksy. What did they do? Do you think they knew what God's commands for the people of God were, for them were? Of course, they knew something was different about these people. They weren't allowed just to bebop into camp, right? They had to be, you can't just, any old person couldn't come into camp that they wanted to, especially certain parts of camp. They had to be clean. And so there were those kind of things that they knew were different. But the text reads as though that the Midianites did this intentionally. That they took them astray intentionally from their God, is how this reads. In Joshua chapter 13, verse 22, Balaam and others are killed because of this event right here. This comes around again. Joshua chapter 13, verse 22. This comes around again. And we see because of the trickery, because of what they did. So this text reads, in God's mind, they did this intentionally. It wasn't that they're just like, "Hey, come in here and have potluck with us," right? That wasn't what they were doing. There was some intent here on their part to get these people to go a different direction. All right, chapter 26, we get to count again. Some of you guys are really good at counting. You do it for a living. But we see this census taking place. There's a command for the census to do it again. Those who are 20 years old and upward by their father's households, verse 2 of chapter 26, and they're to take a census. The book of Numbers is almost kind of bookended by these census. And why is it important that we're doing a census again? What kind of unfolded between the last census and this census? What's that? People died. Yes. Yes. A lot of people died. Yes, sir. A lot of people died. Exactly. Thousands and thousands of people died. That's we're in this situation. Now, but on the flip side, thousands and thousands of people had to be born as well, and we're going to see that here in just a second. But they did wrong. They had they done everything right, you know, and we can look back on our lives exactly and say, well, had I done everything right, things would have been a bit different. But had they done what God asked them to do, they would already be conquering the land. They'd already be, you know, sitting in their nice walled houses and that kind of stuff, and raising the grandkids in, you know, all these houses that they didn't build and those kind of things, right? So had they done things right, but that didn't go the way, they didn't go that way. So now they had to wander in the wilderness for 40 years, and now there's this next generation that's come up, right? And so they have a recount of everybody. And so we're going to go, like, we have, beginning of verse 5, we have Reuben. Reuben, it says, counted 43,730, those who are 20 and upward, to go into war. That is 2,770 low from where they were before. They went down. Very few went up. What's interesting here, too, is they mention the rebellion of Korah. What unique thing happened at the rebellion of Korah? What unique physical, earth-shattering thing happened at the rebellion of Korah? The ground opened up, right, and swallowed them all up. In my mind, that's just crazy, all right? So it opened them up, swallowed them up, and you had the 250 men that died in front of the tent that were trying to be priests as well. And it says it happened that there was a warning, it was a sign. Even Jude verse 11 talks about this, the rebellion of Korah, as a warning of rebellion against God. And so it becomes this perpetual warning, kind of a byword of rebellion against God. And so not all the sons of Korah died is kind of the mentions we have here as well. But with Simeon, we have 22,200. That is 37,100 less than where they were before. So not good, Simeon, right? The sons of Gad, 40,500. That is 5,150 less. The sons of Judah, 76,500. That's a tick up. They gained 1,900. Now, does that mean that in those 40 years, 1,900 people were born to that clan? No. That means they replaced all of their soldiers plus 190,000. It's a lot of babies, right? It's a lot of in 40 years. Then we have Issachar, 64,300. That's a plus 9,900. With the sons of Zebulun, they went up 3,100 from where they were before. Manasseh went up 20,500. The sons of Ephraim, 32,500, went down 8,000. The sons of Benjamin went down 10,200 to 45,600. And then the sons of Dan, according to all their families, went up 1,700. The sons of Asher went up 11,900. And the sons of Naphtali went down 8,000 to 45,400. So the total, if you tally them all up, 601,730 is 1,820 less than where they were before. Why are we talking about all that? Well, why are the numbers important? Look in verse 52. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, among these the land shall be divided for an inheritance according to the number of their names. I don't know if you've ever been given a challenge, and if you knew the end result of the challenge, you might have tried harder. I don't know if you've ever been in that situation. But had they known, right, that at the end, if they had more children, they would get more land, I think they would have tried harder. Maybe. I don't know. Just a thought. Throwing it out there. But their lands were decked, how much land they got was correlated with how many people, which makes sense, right? Verse 54, to the larger group you shall increase their inheritance, and to the smaller group you shall diminish their inheritance. Each shall be given. Now, they were all, I can't back that up, but all those who were fighting age, we know were going to die. The text tells us all those were going to die. In verse 63, it says, those who were numbered by Moses and Eleazar, the priest, who numbered the sons of Israel in the plains of Moab by the Jordan at Jericho. But among these, there was not a man of those who were numbered by Moses and Aaron, the priest. What is that saying? So Moses and Eleazar numbered this 601,000 plus, but none of the ones that were numbered by Moses and Aaron. Where is Aaron right now at the writing at the taking of the census? He's been gathered unto his descendants, right? He is no longer amongst the land of the living. So we're talking about here with like this, the passing of a generation into right now. When we talk about the difference between Moses and Aaron and Moses and Eleazar, we're talking about two different censuses and two different groups of people altogether. Now, who was numbered amongst them? who was numbered amongst them. What's that? Yes, Joshua and Caleb were the only ones in verse 65, except Caleb the son of Jephunneh and Joshua the son of Nun. Look over in chapter 14 of Numbers. Chapter 14, let's go back. Chapter 14, and if you want to write out here, chapter 14, and if you're so inclined to write in your Bible, chapter 14, verses 28 through 35 would go really well next to verse 64. But chapter 14, beginning of verse 28, and this is where God kind of brings the hammer down on them. The Lord spoke to Moses saying, "How long shall I bear with this evil congregation who are grumbling against me?" And he says in verse 28, "As I live, says the Lord, just as you have spoken in my hearing, so I will surely do to you. Your corpses will fall in the wilderness, even all your numbered men, according to your complete number, for 20 years old and upward, who have grumbled against me, except Caleb and Joshua." And so we see this culmination here in chapter 26 of these things that took place. Now, when we look through the reading of these tribal names, which ones are not counted among the warriors? The tribe of Levi are not counted among the warriors. Why are they not counted among the warriors? They are the priests. They're separated out for God's special use. Now, they do count them in this census from a month old and upward, but they're not counted as those who are to be used in war. So they number 23,000. So they're a small group, even counting a month up. So a month old and upwards. All right, so now we get into chapter 27, some legal issues. Some things happen as they're going through the wilderness that kind of bring up some other legal ramifications. And in this case, we have the daughters of Zelophehad, the son of Hepher, the son of Gilead, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, the families of Manasseh, the son of Joseph. So we have this line here. In verse 3, they bring their case to Moses. "Our father died in the wilderness, yet he was not among the company of those gathered themselves together against the Lord and the company of Korah." All right. Do you see that distinction? Our father died in the wilderness. But he wasn't one of these Korah kids, right? He wasn't over there with the Korahites, right? "But he died in his own sin and he had no sons. Why should the name of our father be withdrawn from among the family because he had no son? Give us a possession for our fathers." And God says in chapter 27, verse 7, the daughters of Zelophehad are right in their statements. They are correct in what they're saying. "You shall surely give them a hereditary possession among their father's brothers." And he says, "Further, you shall speak to the sons of Israel, saying, if a man dies and has no son, then he shall transfer his inheritance to his daughter. If he has no daughter, then he shall give his inheritance to his brothers. If he has no brothers, then he shall give his inheritance to his father's brothers." And we see this, that the inheritance doesn't pass on to any other family. It stays within, as much as possible, within that family. And then he says in verse 11, "And that shall be a statutory ordinance to the sons of Israel, just as the Lord commanded Moses." And so when that happens, when that phrase happens, there's a stamp that says, this is how this is going to go. This is how land is going to be passed on if they're in the case where there are no sons to receive the land. And so they receive some land. Chapter verse 12, we have a statement here. The Lord says to Moses, "Go up to this mountain of Abiram and see the land which I have given the sons of Israel. When you have seen it, you too will be gathered to your people as Aaron your brother was. For in the wilderness of sin, during the strife of the congregation, you rebelled against my commandment to treat me as holy before their eyes at the water. And these are the waters of Meribah, Kadesh, in the wilderness of sin." And so he's reminded of why he was going to be not going into that promised land. And he's saying, you're going to go up to this mountain. But there's some things that are going to happen before that event. In the beginning of verse 15, Moses spoke to the Lord, saying, "May the Lord, the God of Israel, of all flesh, appoint a man over the congregation who will go out and come in before them and bring them in so that the congregation of the Lord will not be like sheep which have no shepherd." Does that sound familiar? Matthew chapter 9, beginning in verse 35. Matthew chapter 9. Why do you think Moses mentions sheep? Why does Moses mention sheep in his analogy here? Does he know the sheep? Does he talk to the sheep? What does Moses know about sheep? He was a shepherd, right? He was a shepherd. He knows silly sheep. He knows how they are not going to be able to lead themselves. And he's had experience with these sheeples, right? Are they going to be able to lead themselves? No, it is evident that they are not going to be able to lead themselves. And so he says this, that they're going to be without a shepherd. And Jesus says, as he's going through all the cities and the villages in Matthew chapter 9, teaching in their synagogues, proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom, and healing every kind of disease, every kind of sickness, seeing the people, he felt compassion for them because they were distressed, dispirited, like sheep without a shepherd. Who was supposed to have been the shepherd in Jesus' time? Who was supposed to have been the shepherds of Israel? The religious leaders, right? The high priest and the Levite, they were supposed to be the religious leaders. But instead, they were what? Distressed and dispirited, like sheep without a shepherd. They had, quote-unquote, shepherds, but they were not the kind of shepherds. They were, as one man said, they were more like cowboys than shepherds in dealing with the sheep. So this idea of God having compassion on his people and providing leadership, God is not one to just let them leave them to their own devices. Well, they did wrong, I'm just going to let them wallow in it. No, he continues to guide them, even when they've done wrong, and continues to provide guidance for them. So the Lord said to Moses, beginning verse 18 of chapter 27 in the book of Numbers, so the Lord said to Moses, take Joshua the son of Nun, a man in whom is a spirit, and lay your hand on him, and have him stand before Eleazar the priest, before all the congregation, and commission him in their sight. Why is it important that this gets happened like in front of everybody? A regime change. Why is it important that a regime change is open and honest and transparent? So everybody knows this is what happened. Everybody knows this is according to the commandment of God. And you're not still counting ballots, right? So this is important, right? It's important that these things happen. It's open and honest in front of everybody. That was a joke. Sorry, Aaron. Okay, that was a joke. Just a joke. All right. So that was important. Why was it important? Did Moses get his command like questioned ever? Even Aaron, right? Even his own brother questioned his leadership. And so God is putting in place those things that need to take place so that that does not happen to Joshua as well. And so it happens to everybody. It's in front of everyone so everybody can see it. And they even, in verse 21, moreover, he shall stand before Eleazar the priest, who shall inquire for him by the judgment of the Urim before the Lord. So like all the things are happening here so that all the people will know that this is God making this decision and this is how this is being handed down. And, you know, if you've read and seen through how Joshua has been working with Moses this whole time, it probably wasn't a stretch that this was going to be taking place. And then verse 23 says, he laid his hands on him and commissioned him just as the Lord had spoken. Chapter 28, we get into some laws about offerings, which are super exciting, usually. Sometimes anyway, it can be interesting. But we look here in chapter 28, and we see some offerings. We see the daily offering that's supposed to take place every day. Then we see the ramifications for, and these are not my individual offering that I make for myself. These are congregational offerings. These are everybody. You look, see how expensive these things are. God is not requiring everybody to do this every day. These offerings are made on behalf of all the congregation at that time. And these things, you know, how are they making these comfortable? Well, when you tithe all your sheep and you tithe all your goats and you give your best to God in that tithe for what they were commanded to do. From that tithe come these kinds of offerings. And so they are providing that in this way. And so we see the daily offering, we see the Sabbath offering, the offering at the first of the month, and then we see the Lord's Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread in verses 16 through 25, and then the offering of first fruits as well. And so we have we're not going to go into all the details, but you can go through here. What's interesting, over and over again, you have on certain parts or certain days of these offerings, you have this concept, like in verse 18 of chapter 28, and the first day shall be a holy convocation, you shall do no laborious work. And then you'll see it over and over again, a holy convocation, and you shall do no laborious work. And you see over and over again, connected with these feast days is a concept where there's no laborious work to be done in connection with these feast days, which is teachers why you have a lot of days off in Palm Beach County. So these things are connected with those feast days. They're not supposed to do any work in connection with those feast days. And that continues in chapter 29, where we have the offerings of the seventh month, and it tells like specific days of the month, of the seventh month, those offerings that are supposed to be made. And it continues with the holy convocation as well on these select days in chapter 29. So again, really, really quick. We don't need to go into all of these, but if you want to look at and see the things that they're supposed to do as they go through and what they're supposed to offer. Now, when they offer and make these offerings, can they bring just any old sheep? No. God is super specific on the things that they're supposed to be brought to them and the condition with which it is supposed to be brought in this sacrifice. So these things that are being sacrificed on this day are supposed to be without defect of any sort before God. And God is serious about being worshipped in a certain way. What's interesting is we see this in the Old Testament and these specific days, times, mornings and evenings, specific types of sacrifices, the condition they're supposed to be in, who's supposed to do it, what they're supposed to be wearing, and down to the genealogy of those who are supposed to be involved in it. God is specific. And then we go into the New Testament, and where God says, do this thing, we say, well, he didn't say we couldn't do all these other things. Do you see where that doesn't compute, right? It doesn't work. If God is specific on a thing, that's what he means. This is a thing. This is what we do. And God says, sing and make melody. God says, worship on the first day of the week. God says, do these things. And we copy that pattern and do that thing. But sometimes we allow ourselves certain liberties that aren't there. And God has said, this is the thing you're supposed to do. And so when we see God wanting a people to be holy and a special treasure unto him, we see that here with these people, and he prescribes the way they're supposed to do it. Chapter 30, law of vows. How many of you have made vows lately? Right. So when we look at these, we have, if a man makes a vow in verse 2, if a man makes a vow to the Lord or takes an oath to bind himself with a binding obligation, he shall not violate his word. He shall do according to all that it proceeds out of his mouth. So be careful what you say, right? Now, verse 3 says, if a woman makes a vow to the Lord and binds herself by any obligation in her father's house, this is in her youth, she's not a married woman, her dad, the father, has an opportunity to say, well, no, you don't really need to do that. If he hears about it, and if he knows about the vow she's made, as soon as he hears it, he has an opportunity to say, no, that's beyond what you're able to do. I don't think that's supposed to be, you shouldn't be do that. And he can stop that vow. What do you think happens in verse 6 if a woman is married and she makes a vow? What happens? The husband then takes that role, right? The husband takes a role, and if he hears it and is aware of it, or when he's made aware of it, he has an opportunity right then to say something to the contrary or allow her to continue with this vow. But if he doesn't, then she will have to do this. Now, in verse 9, it says, if a vow of a widow or a divorced woman, everything by which she has bound herself shall stand against her. But then he goes into talking about those who were not annulled. If her husband heard it but said nothing, verse 11, and did not forbid her, then all her vows shall stand, and every obligation which she bound herself shall stand. But if her husband indeed annuls them on the day he hears them, then whatever proceeds out of her lips concerning those vows, the obligation herself shall not be bound. Every vow, verse 13, binding oath to humble herself, her husband, make him be confirmed, the husband may annul it. But if indeed he says nothing, verse 14, from day to day, that is from several time, a period has passed, and he doesn't confirm it, then it'll be at his hand. He will bear the guilt then of that. Yes? So what's really nice about Hebrew literature is we're not super linear all the time in how we do something. And so it goes up to this point of verse 9, talking about the widower. Then it goes back in verse 10, start talking again about the other side of somebody who is no longer a widower or wasn't a widower. So it's tricksy that way. So we go back and start talking again about those who have been married. And then a husband's role again. And that's a very good question. I meant to bring that up. So thank you for catching that. Super studious. So excellent. These, verse 16, these are the statutes which the Lord commanded Moses as between a man and his wife and as between a father and his daughter while she is in her youth in the father's house. So these are vows. The father figure played a role in making sure those vows would be able to be kept if they were something that should be honored, and likewise a husband, because they would involve the father a lot of times as well, and then the husband as well. Thoughts, questions, comments? Shout-outs. I know you guys are just aching to be done, so you can go back and start reading about all those sacrifices. Start memorizing those tonight. So anyway, thank you very much for your time tonight, and appreciate it.